Hey, Danger Dan Jurz here with a quick announcement. Our next interstitial bonus content will be Daniel's Power Rangers mini campaign, and it will be the final one before the start of Season 2 officially begins. It's a soft Season 1 epilogue slash side story that will be releasing exclusively on Patreon, with its first episode dropping Wednesday, May 27th. Stick around after the episode to hear a sneak preview. More details about Season 2 will be coming soon, so keep an ear out and enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, a show where I chat with other creators in the TTRPG space about how they run their tables. I'm Danger Dan Jurz, the GM and host of D&D Dark, and joining us at the table today is the host and GM of the Pathfinder 2E Remastered Actual Play podcast, Epic Tales and Critical Fails, as well as 2025 Crit Award nominee for Best GM in a Paizo game, Michael. Hello.
Hello.
To get us started, can you tell us a little bit about who you are, what your history with the TTRPG community is, and about your show?
I originally got involved in TTRPG because I watched a little-known thing called Critical Role back in the day. Probably never heard of it. I watched that, thought it was fun, watched a couple of episodes, and was... I've always been a storyteller, and there was this opportunity to do something that was scratch that itch to tell a story and to share it with people, which I think is always the passion, you know, the actual getting it out there and getting other people involved. So I convinced my other half that we should try D&D. So we went to a local games club and played with a few people. We ended up trying out first edition D&D, then fifth edition D&D. Then I ran a campaign for fifth edition that ran on from 2019 to 2023. They went from first to 20th level. And then it was kind of like, we've got the bug at this point. So we then decided that we'd shift over to Pathfinder and give that a go. It was kind of an option to do something different. But also there was some weird shenanigans going on with various, you know, licenses and things. And it didn't sit right with me. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go play something else now. And we wanted to do a podcast because it kept the group together. So one of the things that we'd been quite keen on is we just got out of lockdown in the UK. And a lot of us joined together and started playing together at that point because we had various different people change in and out of the group over the years. And we wanted to do something that kept us all playing together, that gave us the motivation to keep going. So we started making the podcast and Epic Tales came around. And it's a bit of cosmic horror meets Pathfinder, I think is the best way of describing it. You've got some completely bonkers villains who are up to no good and some players who clearly most of the time have no idea what they're doing. And it does make for some entertaining moments at the table. We try to have fun. It's always been about playing around the table for us. And the recording, it's kind of secondary. It's fun to do, but it's like if we're having fun, then people will probably enjoy listening to it. That's the way we've always taken it. So we started with a story about some weird dreams that all the characters are having, all involving a ship and some bizarre backstories that none of them understand. And they went from there. They start with the Clockwork Automata going rampaging around the market and kick on to face all sorts of hideous bugs and things that have come along since and many stranger things that have coming further down the line that we've recorded but haven't quite released yet.
That's fantastic. I love the whole mindset that you're approaching that with of using the project as a pretense to keep the game going. One of the things that I want to unpack a little bit, your jump from first edition to fifth edition to Pathfinder, I want to know what that transition process was like in changing those systems and in kind of learning. I would kind of argue that first edition to fifth edition D&D is a bigger leap than fifth edition to Pathfinder. But in either respect, can you tell me a little bit about what it was like transitioning between those systems and what that learning curve was like?
It was one of those circumstances where we found a group of people who were playing at the local pub, to be honest, and they were playing first edition D&D. So it was kind of, all right, well, we've got some D&D here. Let's go and have a play. And then we started playing fifth edition alongside it. I preferred the fifth edition. I didn't like the meat grinder sort of feel of the first edition. It was like, oh, yeah, you've got a character, but don't love them because they'll be dead by the end of the session or something. And it was like, okay. So we were doing the two at the same time. And of course, we were watching things, learning how to do it by watching other people experience it as well, which was quite fun and a good way of learning it. When we moved over to Pathfinder, it was a learning curve because we did the inadvisable thing. What most people say is the inadvisable thing. I think anything's doable if you've got enough enthusiasm. But we transitioned our characters over. So we took fifth edition characters and remade them. And we managed to get all of them closer to what the person had imagined them being in the first place. I managed to keep everything the same. And then we were learning the rules as we went along. So it felt a little, there was a lot of rules that were strange, like all these conditions that suddenly crop up with Pathfinder. You know, suddenly you've got Sickened going on and all these other things that sort of have their roots back in sort of 3.5 D&D. But once we started to get a handle on that, it was actually quite similar. It was actually simpler because it was like, you've got three actions, what are you going to do with them? And it kind of got rid of those, have you got a bonus action? Are you moving? Are you not? Kind of, it's like, you've got to think about what you're doing. And it also rewards teamwork. So it was a bit of a jump, but I always took the view of, if people were having fun at the table, then everything else doesn't matter. If you get a rule right or wrong, we'll learn about it. The game we transitioned over, my other half was playing a gunslinger, and till the day we stopped playing those characters, never realized you needed an interact action to rotate the pepper box.
Mm.
And it was like, oh, right, we got that one wrong. Nobody cared. Nobody minded. So it was a good environment to learn in. And then to take it to the podcast when we had a bit of a better handle on it, we still get it wrong. There's still moments where we go, there's just so many rules, you don't remember them off the top of your head. And you just go with what you think is right and worry about it later.
And that's ultimately what's more important. I feel like that's a very common thread among the actual play space, especially with a system like Pathfinder, where the rules are more intricate and structured. Like, kind of the trade-off there, at least from my limited experience, is that there's a lot less that's open to interpretation compared to 5e. The sheer detail that the rules go into make it hard to kind of keep track of in your head. In like the tiny bit of experience that I've had, I like to think of Pathfinder as a little more video gamey than 5e, just because of how structured everything is into like skill trees and keywords, which is both helpful and not in looking up rules. It's top of mind for me because we're in between our seasons right now for similar reasons that you switched over from 5e to Pathfinder. We are transitioning our second season from a 5e podcast to a Pathfinder podcast. When all of the Wizards of the Coast nonsense was going on, we were too deep into the middle of the campaign and figured, okay, we will finish out this campaign in 5e, and then the next one that we do will shift over into Pathfinder and give that a try. Similar experience with you porting the characters over. The characters that we were setting up for our second campaign, we got in a lot more detail, a lot closer to the original intention with. I think Pathfinder's character creation system is a lot more robust than D&D 5e's is, and so that's a really big benefit that I see there.
Yeah, I mean, I like the customization of it in general. The one thing, having played high level 5e, and it's a great introduction because you can run it with very little knowledge of the game. Mm-hmm. So it's a great platform to start with. But once you get so far, the game doesn't really run as smoothly as you want it to. You get to 10th level and suddenly it's like, we're now dealing with demigod players who can do whatever they want, cool down a god or whatever, and suddenly you're like, all right, how do I balance this and make it challenging? And that's one of the things I've always enjoyed about, you know, playing the role-playing games and things like D&D is challenge the players. You know, I'm a big fan of Dark Souls and things like that. It's like, it's got to be challenging, but you've got to be winnable. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it when we were playing 5e from sort of 11th level onwards was just constant working of homebrewing the monsters, homebrewing the items. And by the end of the game, when we finished at 20th level and they fought a Lovecraftian monster from beyond the stars, we suddenly realized, well, actually, when we look at the rules of Pathfinder and these three actions and the choices you've got, we were kind of baking that in with all of the work that we were doing behind the game. So it was quite nice to be able to say, here's something that does everything we want and I don't have to do it. I don't have to play with it. Things like the encounter design is just really satisfying for me because I can go and pull a monster out the book and run it in the podcast or run it in one of the other games that we play. And I know what it's going to do. I know what challenge level it will be and how it will work in that context. Whereas if I do it with D&D, it's like, will that lich be challenging to these characters? I did try a lich once and they wiped the floor with it. And it was like, well, I had no fun. So I do. I enjoy that customization. I enjoy the fact it rewards teamwork. You know, one person scares the thing, it falls over or gets knocked down, and suddenly somebody else leaps on it. I think one of my favorite things that it was a GM moment of, I forgot you'd put grease on the floor. And I ran into the square with the grease on the floor. And of course, my amazing sorceress just fell over on her backside. And along came the fighter who didn't hit her in the turn, just waited for the reactive strike to trigger as she got up. And it was like, yeah. So the druid knocked me down and you've killed me. Well done. But I like those kind of things where it's the teamwork and the tactics that work together. You see the players doing all sorts of creative ideas and creative things.
It really is fantastic. And that's a big thing that I've heard as far as people who are more experienced in Pathfinder that they have all commended the system for, is that as far as tactics go, it's much less of the individual power fantasy that 5e is, and much more of a good team building exercise. So like you kind of mentioned briefly with the way that mechanics kind of build and stack on each other, and one player's turn will apply a condition that sets up another player to take advantage of it on their turn. What kinds of things does Pathfinder do? And for any of our listeners who would be less familiar with the Pathfinder system, can you give just a brief overview of Pathfinder and its particular strengths and what some of the benefits are compared to something like 5e and some of the drawbacks?
So the basic principle of Pathfinder is, as with D&D, it runs on those three strands of gameplay: the exploration, the combat, and the downtime. And it kind of builds into those, and it runs fairly similar. When you're playing at the table, it doesn't feel awfully different. But the main kind of features of it is that it's a three-action economy when you get into combat. Whereas with 5e is action, bonus action, movement. Pathfinder 2e gives you three actions. Now choose what you're going to do. Going to cast a spell? That's cost two. Are you going to move? That's cost one. Do you want to attack three times on your first turn at a first level fighter? You can, but there's a penalty that applies to each subsequent attack. So there's all sorts of options. You get more that you can do early on with these three actions, because immediately a first level character can intimidate the creature. They can feint against it if they're particularly, deceptive. They can go, hey, look over there, and try to create a distraction. So there's all of these different things that are built in. I ran a game for a new group the other week, and one of the players said to me, I can do so much and I'm a first level fighter. That's the biggest compliment for me, when you feel like you can do more rather than swing, miss, your turn's over. So it's those three actions you can do a lot with, and they give you a lot of options at first level, because by the time you built your character, you've got your ancestry, so elf, dwarf, whatever it may be. There are many, many fun and exotic variants. Spider people are in there somewhere. Then you get your background. So if you're a barrister, you get legal lore and you get some certain stat boosts and things like that. So they all have a role to play in the mechanics of it. And that feeds into those three actions of what are you going to be good at? And the real critical difference is you become a specialist in what you do. So the wizard will be a specialist in magic stuff, whereas the fighter will be a specialist in knocking things over, but they will be very good at what they do and have no chance of doing what they can't. So it gives a lot of customization. You could have a party full of bards if you really wanted to, and each one of them could be different. You know, you can have clerics that will be wildly different because they've got a different god or a different, different font that they use. And for all of those people who hate being heal bots, well, the clerics are designed to make sure that you don't have to do that, because you get loads of spells extra to cast healing spells. And then the rest of them, you could put your divine bombs in them or whatever you want to do. It's got a huge customization, a huge range of skills, and they all boil down into this three action economy. There's all sorts of different tactical elements to it that gives you more freedom, I think, is one thing. The drawback, if it's even fair to say that, is the complexity. Once you start getting into the weeds, the more you learn, the more complicated it becomes. And there are some classes which are just, you steer beginners away from, because certainly pre-remaster, I ran an Oracle NPC and I had to forever remember what happened when he got cursed, because the Oracle has a mechanic where they cast a spell and they get cursed and it has an impact on them. So there's all sorts of things you have to keep track of. But if you've got a decent app that does it for you, and we use, Path Builder, It makes it so much simpler, because you can just press a button and it's all there for the players and they know what's going on. So actually, once you've got tools for it, or if you're using Foundry or another VTT, that complexity becomes less of an issue. I've had players who've even just kept track of it with little counters on the table. So it's, as long as you find a way of keeping those things visible and remembering them and keeping each other honest at the table, I think it's okay. But yeah, the complexity can be off-putting. But once you get into it and you start running it, it doesn't actually feel too different from D&D 5e. It's just the structure of the combat and the turns that you would take.
That's a very good overview of it. That matches up with a lot of what I've heard. One of the big things that I heard from a TikTok creator, I don't remember exactly who it was, but it was somebody in the process of transitioning from 5e to Pathfinder, brought up that it took a little bit for everything to click, but then they hit a certain point where all of a sudden the pathways opened up and they understood exactly how the system worked. It's a system with a lot of minutiae, but having those systems makes a big difference. I've done a couple of one-shots in Pathfinder and leaned very, very heavily on both Path Builder and then Archives of Nethys, the fan wiki, was incalculably important. Being able to just quickly look up and reference any of the different minutiae of conditions or the action cost of different things between those two sources that covered 100% of the ground of any rules clarifications that we needed, anything like that. There's some really great tools for creators in that space. And so those are the two that I experienced with a little bit, and both I cannot recommend highly enough.
Yeah, I can't even remember how I came across Path Builder, but it was one of those things. If I gave it to people, here, we're transitioning our characters, go play with it. And they came back and said they'd been sitting on the bus going into work, making characters. And it became slightly addictive. And there's so many of my friends have dozens of characters that they've got ready to go just in case theirs die. I had an immense bit of fun where I was playing the Strange Aeons adventure path with some friends, and one of them's an investigator. He's a pumpkin leshy. And he was roughing up a cultist, as you do in these things. And he said, oh, wait, let me just check there's no lawyers about. And of course, I then was like, all right, fair enough. You say it, I'll do it. There's a lawyer walks around the corner and he's this old man who's like, oh, hello, what are you doing? And he became a bit of a running joke. And I thought, well, I've made up this guy for a joke, but I want to see, can the system build him? He was a man with a dog. He was like a Yoda, the lawyer, basically. And I got hold of the Path Builder. I was playing with it and I managed to build a bard that was a barrister background, a human bard barrister background, the Beastmaster dedication. So he got his dog and his dog was huge. It was the size of a horse. It was ridiculous. But then all of his spells I would pick would be things that made sense from a lawyer, like he would soothe his clients or he would bury you in legal paperwork with the curse of lost time. So there was it let you take what was a 5-minute joke and turn it into something that was actually really fun to play. So it's the flexibility it gives you. You could come up with an idea and you can go, wait, can I make this? And it's actually quite possible because they keep adding new choices. Mm-hmm. So things just get more and more detailed. That for me really kind of was the moment I looked at it and went, this system's nuts. I can do whatever I want and I can make this character. Good old Silas the Joke. Probably one of my favorite characters to have played in Pathfinder because it was just such a test of the flexibility of the system. And it was amusing that it actually managed to work.
The big mind-blowing thing for me with the flexibility of the system and how robust the character creation is was porting over our character concepts for our second season. For our second season, it's going to be set in America in the 1930s, and the player characters are all going to be cryptids. And the first one that I tackled was the Loch Ness Monster and was like, okay, I'm probably going to have to do some homebrew here to make it work. Shockingly not. And being able to make a dinosaur sea monster as a viable build with no homebrew, completely rules as written, bust open the floodgates for me. It's like, okay, it is ridiculous how accommodating this system is to whatever character concepts.
Yeah, there are some character concepts that, especially with Epic Tales, where one of the players is the grandmotherly gnome who runs the pub. And I think their inspiration was something from a British soap. And so they run this pub and they have a snail as a familiar. And it's the only person I've ever known who managed to find a way to make the system kill them because they said, she's an old lady, so she has no dexterity. And you're just like, in Pathfinder, plus 10 over the roll is a critical hit. So good luck with that. And surprisingly, she never got killed by a crit. She got set on fire and it was the persistent damage that got her. It wasn't the critical hits, which amazed me, but it's one of those. I like the fact that you can crit more easily in a sense. You know, there are some enemies that's going to be hard and there are some enemies where you'll feel that power fantasy. If there's a bunch of goblins run out from a cave and you're a third level character, you're going to annihilate them, but it's going to feel good. And it makes it so much simpler than having to go, what stats should happen here? Because by the time I was homebrewing monsters for 20th level in D&D, I'd thrown out every rule. I just didn't even look at the books anymore.
Yeah.
Because their final enemy in that campaign was Cthulhu himself. So he arrives and he's got a sentient planet for a companion. And he had 7 legendary actions. He had multiple different choices. I mean, it were a fairly big group, to be honest. There were about 6 players. And they kept dragging NPCs with them. They were always recruiting somebody. So it was kind of those things of, I've got to do something to make this creature still be threatening. And it took them 2 sessions to take them both down. But it was a lot of work because I knew where it was going. It was one of those, I was tinkering with that for years. I'd had that monster, designed it, redesigned it, done it again. So it's much nicer to be in a situation where I can go, oh, I've got a session in 20 minutes. I just need a creature for this room that's unique or something. And I can do that quite easily. And it takes a lot of pressure off the GM, that's for sure. That's my experience of it, once you get through that learning curve. But yeah, our friend did manage to find the only character that probably breaks the system, which is one with no dex.
That's fantastic. To transition more specifically to your show is a homebrew campaign that is set in the world and lore that Pathfinder sets up. I know since it spun off of 3.5 D&D, there's a lot of overlap and similarities, but what specifics about the world are unique to your story, whether it be stuff that you're pulling from Pathfinder, stuff that you're pulling from other media influences? What generally are you looking for as inspiration for your personal storytelling? And what can you tell us about your lore and your world?
So when we transitioned over and we started playing, I wanted to focus on the storytelling because I've still been doing this a very short space of time, really, thinking about 2019 to now. So I wasn't quite at the stage where I was like, I'm going to do a homebrew world. I think I might do one for like one shots or something. But at the minute, it's like, you know, there's enough in life without having to create a world. But the wonderful thing about what Pathfinder releases is they give you so much. So if you want to play in, the city at the center of the world, then there's a whole book on it. If you want to play in countries that draw from East Asian myth, there's the option to do that. Same for African myth. It's a bit of a patchwork world in that there's something for everybody. So there's a place that's a bit like Transylvania. There's a place that's spaceships and lasers. You know, there's all sorts of different options to give you a base for it. There might be inspiration comes from the lore and comes from the splat books, because I've got quite a few I've collected from first edition. But often it's the throwaway sentences of, oh, this is here, but no one knows why. And then suddenly you go, all right, that's a story in itself. And you start to ask the question of, well, what's this big thing that's happening in the background? They're all having these shared dreams. How do I get from shared dreams to some kind of world-ending threat, which is usually where I end up? I like bringing in those kind of eldritch horrors and those things that, because Pathfinder has a history, actually, of the very first adventure path that was released, Rise of the Rune Lords, culminates with an eldritch Lovecraftian being involved in all of it. And then they did the strange Aeon's Adventure Path, which was a collaboration with Chaosium, who they drew across the Call of Cthulhu mythos that their game had built up into the Adventure Path. So those are the inspirations, really, that kind of mix and balance between these super powerful people, but also giving them a kind of a worthy threat. The sort of, you know, here's the Avengers, but we need a Thanos of some description in order to stand against them. As you start layering onto it, you've got this great baseline, but then it becomes your world and all of those throwaway comments become suddenly something that just spins you off. In fact, the first arc of the campaign all came about because of a joke that was to do with Baldur's Gate 3 because of the old bug with Gale that if you let him down gently, he would ruin every other romance in the game. And it became a running joke that Gale became an enemy. So Gale cropped up as something in one shot. Then suddenly it was like, do you know what? Can I make Gale the acronym for an automata? And I got the Grand Absalomian Legerdemain Enchanter. So I made a fairground robot. Then he became this idea of, he's now seen everybody else. He's realized I'm this automata. I was made to be a fairground entertainer. And I wasn't meant to be sentient. Now I am. But look at you lot, all throwing it away on booze and crime and all of these other things. So he's decided that the best way to do that is to subjugate everybody and lead them back to moral righteousness. And that was the kind of starting point, the campaign. It was this automata who's stuck between two worlds and is so convinced he's right. Suddenly you've got to have these group of heroes interfere and go and say, well, actually, no, we've got to stop him. He's an entertaining character, is good old Gale. And he gets progressively worse. He's a bit like, I always liken him to Ultron. He just builds himself a new body and comes back and he's worse. And he's sort of become more cybernetic as he goes on, because he's like, well, if you're not going to listen to an automata, you'll listen to a cyborg. But there's still so much of it relies on the players. That's the thing. Like, it gives no end of amusement to my other half, who plays Katara, the pirate, that one of the recurring villains is a sunflower leshy, who literally turned up in the first episode simply because somebody said a leshy's common. And I said, yes, you see a sunflower walking down the street. And he just waves at the leshy in your party and goes, oh, hello. And the leshy gave him a stare. So he was immediately like, right, make a note of that. The leshy has spurned the other leshy. So they're often the architects of their own demise, really. You give them the freedom to play, and then you just keep sort of pulling from their thought processes. And I might change something because I'm like, well, you've had a really cool idea, and it really should be that. It should be what you think it is. And that's the fun of it. It's like watching the players change and shape what you do and how you respond to that. I'll pinch anything they say. Any jokes they make usually come back to bite them.
We definitely have had a lot of moments like that in our own show. And it's always interesting, to say the least, to see how the world changes. We had a whole subplot. Core to the main plot, we had the Necronomicon was a central key item. And one of the players, after interacting with it, asked if you could multiclass into Warlock, having accidentally made a pact with an entity through the book. And in the setup, he was trying to do a visual gag of setting up and reading a newspaper, and I was trying to do some like perceptual cosmic fuckery going on of like, oh, you're starting to see the comic strips move and come alive and things like that. And one thing led to another. This was not the intention that we outset. He specifically wanted Nyarlathotep to be the deity that he had pacted with. And then that very quickly got thrown out the window because of the visual gag of things coming alive through primarily the newspaper comic strip. His Warlock patron became Garfield. And that eclipsed a pretty significant chunk of the show. And I went out of my way to try to make the stupid, stupid joke of Lovecraftian Garfield as actually kind of scary as I could get it. But that became a staple of the world building from then on out. The Cat of Orange became one of the most fearsome Lovecraftian entities within the world. We similarly, for messing about with the world play and with GM trusting players, players trusting GMs, one of my players got one over on me, and then I structured his arc specifically to get him back for that exact moment. We had a dream sequence where everyone was kind of trapped navigating a sleep realm, and were not necessarily aware that they were trapped in illusion. The players knew, but the characters didn't. And it was the Phantom of the Opera had his character see through immediately, because he set me up to fail there by giving me, I had him set up like, oh, what kind of music is being performed here? As you see that Christine is singing this song, he specifically called out a German opera that was in the wrong vocal key for what Christine Daae would be able to sing. It's a mezzo aria, and Christine is a first soprano, so I know immediately that this is wrong and everything's out the window. And when I set up his character-specific arc, I had him come across a plot that involved the actual Christine. He wanted to steal her voice for an evil plot that he was hatching as a long-term character goal thing. His favorite musical by the source material would be Johann Goethe's Faustus. And Faust was being performed on stage and Christine was performing it. And I specifically picked a song that was not her vocal type, luring him in with exactly the same setup of, it is a mezzo aria and she is a soprano, so you catch her voice in the wrong key.
Sometimes it is fun to catch them out, but that's where the GM always has that get out of jail card in the back pocket. There's a creature in the story that's there. It's a particularly powerful sort of angel of death. And it's got a vested interest in keeping them alive. So there was always that thing. There's a story reason for it to be there. And it's not just, okay, I'm going to save your character. But there are certainly times when it's like, oh, I forgot to give you hero points. So you can have a hero point. But it's, yeah, often there's something that you've already set up as the GM that you know can get them out of jail. But there's always something. And I tried to make it so that when we do have those moments, it's then explained through the narrative or through some kind of checks that they roll, so that people don't just go, he's constantly trying to save these people. Why? And it's like, no. There is something there that's there for a reason. if it happens that their character dies and there's nothing I can do, then there's nothing I can do. Although the best one with the kind of nothing I can do to save your character actually wasn't to do with them dying. It was to do with me misremembering how poison spray worked in 5e. And I thought it was a cone, and the player cast it in a pub to get away from the guards. And I was like, oh, it's a 15-foot cone. It kills everybody because they've got like 4 hit points. And he got arrested and everything. It was only 6 months later that I realized that it doesn't work like that. Later on, when I said, oh, I'm really sorry that happened, he said, you know what? It was great storytelling.
Those are some of the greatest moments. I try to do a lot of, rather than, I very rarely give the players get out of jail free cards. I usually give them a get out of jail at a steep price card. My death insurance was, if ever there's a TPK or a character permadies, they are now going to the 9 hells, and they will continue the game in the 9 hells while the rest of the campaign plays out, being given the opportunity to escape and work their way out of hell back to life. It was a whole huge ordeal that was a favorite of both of ours for the campaign. And it's stuff like that, or the Necronomicon was also kind of my get out of jail at a steep cost item. I basically gave it so that using the Necronomicon, you can cast any spell on the game, regardless of level, regardless of class or anything, but you would have to make a sanity check every time that you would interact with the book, and you would accumulate exhaustion from using it as a spell focus. So it very quickly put players deep, deep into exhaustion debt and gave for a couple of like pretty clutch escapes. So I love doing things like that. Every once in a while, I will give them a get out of jail free card and give them, usually it will be a reward for their own cleverness. I don't want to indulge in my show too much. So to transition to my next question for you, in the process of running Epic Tales and Critical Fails, what are some of the lessons that you've learned, and how has running this show impacted how you approach TTRPGs as a whole?
The biggest impact is the quality of work that goes into it as a GM. My experience with non-podcast kind of was, I've got a big idea. I might make some monsters 6 weeks in advance, and then I'll have my session will be scribbled out on the back of an A5 piece of paper. You know, I knew what I was doing, but it could flow very easy. But when you're doing a podcast, it's like you want it to have that quality that, you know, people are going to enjoy listening to and are not just sitting there going like, what is he doing now? But also it's made me start to think of, well, how can I do all of this storytelling with things like environment and the locations that they're in? And how do I give them a bit more flavor of the world and all sorts of things that are going on? It involves a lot more work on the story in terms of, you know, if they're going somewhere or something, or they've gone to a shop or something, there's usually a backstory for that person, why they're there, why they were cursed by the hag, all sorts of things. So there's a lot of effort that goes into crafting those things to layer on top of that world that we're playing in. And I think that's the biggest thing I've taken from doing it. It motivated me to go, right, I've really got to prepare this and think of it like the same level of thought into it as if I bought an adventure path and I was playing the adventure path instead. Partly because I like writing the story and I like coming up with these ideas. And it's always fun to go, all right, they've walked into this house and there's paintings on the wall. Now, what paintings are they? And they might be locations that they know about or visit later, or just are there to tell you how bad the person's taste was. I think that's the biggest thing it's taught me, is if you've done the prep, you feel confident in running the show and you feel confident in being the GM, because we sort of did some test sessions and I didn't do a great, you know, I had an idea and it was a bit few notes and I felt like I wouldn't want to record this. It was very much a case of I know what made me feel comfortable as the GM. The thing I still haven't learned, and I freely admit this, is sometimes I will make monsters just too cool. And you're like, why did I make this fight so hard? So often I will sit there, we'll finish one session and they'll be right in the middle of trouble, nothing's going well for them, and you'll pick up a few weeks later. Sometimes you have to row back and go, you know what, I've gone a bit far with this. So my back pocket get out of jail cards are ready just in case. But it's fun to do, I think. And the fact that it keeps the group together is the really big thing for us. You know, it keeps people playing, it keeps people involved. And it's so much fun to just tell a story and to be able to share that and to have people who, you know, suddenly listen to it and then you get a tweet here or a blue sky there. And it's suddenly like, well, it's really cool that somebody else wanted to say, hey, we're waiting for the next episode. We really enjoy it. So it's nice that there's other people who've appreciated it as well. But yeah, those are the big things.
So for anybody who is unfamiliar with your show, what do you think is the best representation of your show, and where should someone start who is unfamiliar with it?
Obviously, the beginning is always the best place to start with anything. Episode one has a special place because it was the initial thing. It was the first time we did it. We got it. We put it out there and they fought a walking brewing machine. So it was one of those quite funny openings. But I guess you can jump on, I think it's episode 10 and 11 are like the Organ Droid part one and two. And that's when they fight Gale in the fair. So those episodes sort of bring to a close that first arc. Then they move into the next one. And so it suddenly starts getting bigger and the story will go back on itself and they'll be reminded about these dreams or they'll have another dream. So it's always the refresher of this is what's going on. There's various breaks where there's the story stops. It kind of reaches a point where something's tied off and it begins again.
One arc concludes and another arc starts.
Yeah. I think it's like Lavender and Dreams or something is one episode where there's a jumping on point because they go to see a priestess about their dreams in order to talk to her. So it sort of picks up the kind of opening scroll, if you like. In terms of favorite episodes, I always think it's the last one we recorded because it's always that thing of you get more confident, you get to know the rules better. We've been releasing the episodes for about a year, but we're probably several episodes ahead when we record. So yeah, I think jumping on, you know, it's one of those things with ongoing shows and ongoing podcasts. You often will jump on at whatever was the last thing just to test it out and then go, okay, I'm not quite sure what that was. Let's go back an episode or three. And I think at some point the intention is that we will do a little summary thing for some of the arcs so people could go, okay, right, I want to know what's going on. Because I like recurring villains. I'd like to think that you can jump on and when that villain next turns up, you'll get a sense of, all right, this is what happened. The funniest one though, the one where our friend's character actually, you know, gets set on fire. They go into the fairground to find this automata. They don't know it's one, the automata at the time. And they meet a bunch of Mortics. And they've set up a little circus. And they've currently, they're practicing their new showstopper, which is these two people are going to get dropped into a tank of man-eating bugs. And they think it's hilarious because they're bored. And the players have come around the corner and there's this candle that's burning through the rope, going to drop these two half-elves into this tank. And the idea was they'll intimidate them or tell them that backup's on the way. And the goblins are cowards, so they'll run. The elves, if they roll high enough, will also run. And then the halfling, who's the ringmaster, will go, okay, you win, I'm leaving, because he's on his own. Instead, they start to sort of go, well, we need to save these people. And then the druid goes, I cast electric arc. And it went from, I'm expecting you to roleplay this out, to, you've just triggered a very dangerous encounter. It was meant to be that they'd cleared some of the board before they started the fight, if they did fight at all. And that was just hilarious because it went from, you need to get this candle and blow it out, to you're now fighting for your lives with a circus of these creatures. And that was quite an entertaining one to run, where you were sort of sitting there looking at it going, I don't know how you guys are going to get out of this. And of course they do, but that was quite an entertaining episode. That was quite entertaining.
We've basically come to the end of my list of questions. Before we wrap up, though, I just want to ask if there's any miscellaneous things that you want to add, any topics that you want to cover that you want to make sure that we hit before we wrap up.
I think the only thing I would say is if you get a chance to have a go at Pathfinder, give it a go, especially if you get somebody who knows the game and is willing to run it. You'll have a lot of fun. And that is the biggest compliment for the GM when you run it for new players and they just come back the following week and are like, I've got so much I can do. I'm having so much fun. So yeah, if you get the opportunity to have a go, don't be put off by the idea that there's crunch, as people will say. It's like, actually, you know, that's what the GM's there for. They worry about that bit. That's their job. Because it's always the thing I say to new players. You tell me what you want to do, I'll tell you what your role. If you're lucky and the GM's married to a player, you get the opportunity for them to always be the kind of other hand at the table who's, oh yeah, this is what you need to look at, or here it is on your app. So yeah, but if you get the opportunity, give it a go.
Absolutely. From the one shots that I've done, it's been an absolute blast. And I'm really looking forward to jumping into a full campaign with it come season two. So to wrap things up in a fairly neat and concise way, can you remind everyone one more time where we can find your show and where we can find you?
Yes, Epic Tales is on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and I think a couple of others, but those are the major ones. And you can also find it on YouTube. We're on Blue Sky, we're on Twitter. We also have a TikTok, which I know nothing about because I've never had a TikTok. We're on social media, on various different social medias. We have an Instagram and things like that. So if we use maps, they'll be on the Instagram for reference. So there's, yeah, we're on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and YouTube.
All right. Well, thank you one more time for hopping on and chatting with me. This has been an absolute delight.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank all of you for listening. One more time, I'm Danger Dan Jers, the GM and host of D&D Dark. I've been chatting with Michael, the host and GM of Epic Tales and Critical Fails, and this has been Table Talk. And I hope you enjoyed what we brought to the table. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Table Talk, created, hosted, and edited by myself, Danger Dan Jers, with artwork by Jordan Nelson. Our guest this episode was Michael from the Epic Tales and Critical Fails podcast. Links to his work can be found in the episode description. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, reach out to us at dndarkpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme song and outro was created by Jeremy Vellucci. Check out more of his works on Instagram at jeremyvellucci_wreckoftime. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time we have a guest take a seat at the table.
Hello and welcome to Super Stryford Regency Rangers, a comedy action adventure loosely based on Sentai and Sensibility by 9th Level Games and starring some of Stratford's most colorful creatures.
You may call me Adrian Alucard Depeche. If you know what my father did, it could be bad.
Looking matronly with her face hidden behind a fan stands the Kuchisake Ona. Doesn't everyone think she's beautiful?
My name is Sir Gordon Topham Hatt. Pleasure to meet you. I like to make stuff go boom.
My name is Richard Milo Renfield.
He's back.
He's just still like that. Oh, God.
Hi, I'm Jordan, and I play Frederick the Loafer.
Oh, my God. Is this the dude that was, like, in that one episode of D&D Dark?
It is the deepest cut of inside jokes that could be made. God.
Are you married, miss?
I am not married.
Kuchisake leans immediately to the group, just pulls a quick huddle. We need to get this trollop out of this fucking town.
We go fight?
I meet you at dawn tomorrow morning.
It's date.
I hope to find love like that someday.
She says that I hit her. I did not hit her. It's not bullshit. I did not. And as you're walking, he just keeps following you.
Oh, God. I believe I have made an unfortunate ally.
On his hips are two pistols, on his back are two rifles, and on his chest, a triple barrel shotgun.
Oh, my God.
I will destroy all of you and destroy this town.
D&D Dark presents Super Stratford Regency Rangers, premiering Wednesday, May 27th, only on patreon.com/DNDarkPodcast.